Welcome to the Midday with Stephanie and Norman. That would be me, and weighing in our third position, and welcome, Garrick Olson.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to be back. Nice to have you back.
Very nice to be back.
Mr. Olson is a classical pianist who's in town here in Madison for a concert this weekend, and you'll be performing three times, and you'll be scaling the mountain.
Yes, the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto.
Yes, that's said to be daunting for even the greatest pianists.
It's a totally daunting piece, yeah. I have to say that now having learned it, this is going to make me sound even older than I am. I learned it 45 years ago when I was 15. My teacher at the time at Juilliard, the now legendary and was even legendary then, Sasha Gorodinsky, said, you know, you can learn it now, so do that and you'll never be afraid of it. And he was right. It still doesn't mean it's easy. I mean, there's a degree between not being afraid of and having something terribly difficult. But the piece was written by the composer, obviously by the composer, and premiered in 1908. I believe.
Yeah, or nine. Mm-hmm,
or
somewhere
nine.
In there.
Mm-hmm. And for a while, he was the only person who played it, and I believe the next person who took it up with success was Horowitz in the late 20s. And then Gieseking took it up around late 30s and gave it up because he sort of opined it's not a piece to learn when you're in middle age. And I think he's probably right, because when you're young, you pattern these things into your nervous system. I could never forget this piece. I mean, I've worked at it so hard. It was my summer project when I was 15 for 4 months.
It's etched into your synapses.
Yeah, because at that age, you're not just learning a piece, you're learning how to play as well. I mean, you always are to a certain extent. But, you know, I mean, I could take a new piece right now and I could look at it and say, oh, my God, I've never seen chords like that. Well, yes, I have, just different ones.
Yeah, Rachmaninoff's generous with those chords. Yeah,
but when I was 15, this was, you know, it was such a struggle to learn it that, as you say, it's etched.
You've got this long span in each hand, what, 13, 14?
No. Oh, well, you're very...
Does that help when you're playing?
Urban legends start on stuff like that. I can't even do what Rachmaninoff does, was to play a 12.
Oh, really?
I can play an 11th in my left hand, but he could plonk a 12. I've heard it on some recordings. But I have a large hand, almost as large as his, and that, of course, is an invaluable assist in a piece like this. But having said that, I have heard pianists with considerably smaller hands and heights scale this piece magnificently, including an unlikely candidate like Alicia de la Rocha, who recorded it very beautifully and played it very heroically.
Martha Argerich is
said
to have done quite well.
She's a little different than Alicia, or the other pianist I was going to name was Vladimir Ashkenazy, who recorded it many times and played it fabulously, who is a smallish person with not a big enough hand, according to him. Martha Argerich is a force of nature. She can play anything. She doesn't have a small hand. She doesn't have a hand as big as me, but she was designed by the creator, if there is one, to play the piano. That is perfect genetics.
You are renowned for having a repertoire that's huge, 80 concertos or so, and the entire Beethoven.
Probably more, yeah.
And I wanted to ask about memory. How do you absorb these pieces and memorize
them? My favorite question, and I'm going to answer it now and not for the rest of the week, because everybody always asks me, especially at receptions, I have to answer this question
okay,
all the time.
Okay, get it over with once.
Well, I'll never get it over with, but I feel like doing a handout sometimes. It's harder to play these things than to memorize them, way harder. Not that memory is negligible. It's not. It's very important, and it's not easy for everybody. But everybody has a different degree of memory skill and retention. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm 60, so mine will probably not be as good as it used to be in a while, but it's still better than average and always has been. I don't memorize instantly, but I learn fairly quickly. But what I mean is to say is that, for example, when I was 15 learning this piece, it was so hard and involved so many different types of virtuoso piano playing that I knew the notes before I mastered the passages. By analogy, think of an actor. Any of us who were native English speakers can learn a Shakespeare role. That doesn't mean we're Sir Laurence Olivier, because what a great actor does is a great deal more than just repeat the words. And that's what I mean by memorization is only the beginning. And usually in a piece like the Rachmaninoff Third, in order to play X passage, and in this piece there's at least 10,000 times this X passage, different passages of incredible difficulty, you have to practice it so many times that the actual knowing of the notes comes way before you can actually do it. Or think of it like great athletics. You know, when you do a triple Lutz or whatever it is on the ice, or all those fancy things they do, you know, if they're doing a triple lutz, they don't say, now, how many times around is that? It's three. I mean, it's you know, you
it's
have to,
built in.
It's built in. You have to, and just to master it, you have to practice it, what, thousands and thousands of times? And still, it's not a sure thing. And that's like our lives, too, because you practice certain passages and pieces thousands of times, and, you know, sometimes they go very well.
So you have almost a muscle memory of
totally.
The...
Okay. Absolutely.
It's in your fingers.
Yeah. I mean, another legendary teacher with whom I studied, Rosina Levine, she always said there are four memories, basically. There's muscle memory, there's ear memory, there's visual memory, and there's analytical memory.
Hmm.
There's another one, but I don't remember what it is.
Yeah, there may be other ones, but those. She talked about the four, and she said when you're having troubles in a piece with your memory, she said try to separate the strands out. Try to learn it muscularly, analytically, ear. Just make sure you can hear it. And what was the other one? Whatever. And visually. Visually is least useful for me. Some musicians have visual memory. I don't. I mean,
see the score
yeah,
in their
I don't memory. Not have visual memory, but some musicians know that, you know, that passage starts at the upper left-hand corner of the page.
Uh-huh.
That's fine. But she said nobody has, and she said very wisely, nobody has a perfect memory of all four kinds. She said, but each branch can be strengthened, and the whole thing makes a weave, which eventually becomes watertight or airtight, and you actually know the passage. But in other words, she felt it wasn't like, oh gosh, I can't memorize this piece or this passage. It's a process to be worked on. It's not something you can or you can't do. And everybody has more or less talent with it, which is why I, for example, play the piano and not the trombone or the violin. I mean, I'm musical, and I would probably do not badly on those, but they're not equivalent gifts, you know? Mm-hmm. Just like a sprinter isn't a weightlifter, but they're both athletes. I mean, yeah, they're both... You know, we're designed to do different things.
You're built to play the piano.
As I mentioned, you know, about Martha Argerich, mm-hmm. who seems to be better designed to do that than anybody alive today. You know, it's genetics, it's training, it's environment, it's everything.
Well, speaking of being built to play one thing or another, let's tap into a polite controversy that has been going on for quite some time now, having to do with, well, Handel and Bach, harpsichord or piano. You won a Grammy for a bridge label CD with Bach's Goldberg Variations and Handel's Suite No. 2.
Oh, I hate to be pedantic. It was for a Beethoven.
It was
for
Beethoven, yeah.
All right. But, well, you
the
should
The Grammy
for
is
this.
Not the arbiter of harpsichord versus piano either.
No, certainly not. But be that as it may, the Goldberg Variations, a substantial work by Bach.
Yeah.
And, of course, Handel, known for his harpsichord suites, and you've turned them into piano music. And why don't we start with hearing just the fugue that is the finale of the Handel, and here it is as Garrick Ohlsson plays it. Well, what do you gain and what do you lose if you play Handel on the piano, do you think?
I think you gain sustained tone color and dynamics, and you lose crisp articulation and rhythmic incisiveness. But I think that's not an original opinion. To really flame the fans of controversy, I mean, I squarely played that last trill from the principal note, and some specialists will scream. But that's why they're specialists. We argue with each other.
It sounds awfully pretty on the piano.
Thank you.
Do you choose a certain piano over another for different eras of music?
No, not really. Yes and no. I mean, the great thing about a piano is that it's a generalist instrument, and the great thing about really good pianists, if you ever hear them trying pianos, is that they turn pianos into their own sound no matter what. However, the better the piano is to start with, On the other hand, that particular piano is one of mine. I have two concert grands. I mean, other people have sailboats. I've got pianos. I've got four or five of them. Two of them are concert instruments. This is a Mason and Hamlin from 1919.
Mason and Hamlin, really?
Yeah, one of the other great American make, which never had as great a career as Steinway, but it was one of the other great American makes. There were many great American makes back in the beginning of the 20th century. America was the world center of piano building of both quality and quantity at that time.
Imagine.
Yeah, yeah. We led Europe, actually, considerably. But the Mason Hamlin is a very beautiful instrument, and this one was a wreck of a piano when I got it, and I had it totally rebuilt by William Schneider in East Lansing, and who's a very expert technician, and it's a beautiful thing. I didn't choose it particularly for the Baroque stuff, because I've recorded Chopin and Beethoven and 20th century stuff on it. You can once again, like I said about specialists, you can drive yourself crazy about instrument peculiarity and particularity. Some people feel it just has to be not only a Hamburg Steinway, but this very particular Hamburg Steinway for their own comfort. And other people are more general. The range is pretty great. I'm medium fussy. I like the piano to be very, very good, but I don't drive myself crazy with it. But I'm also not. There are some great artists who are relatively indifferent. Growing up, there were the two crazies about pianos were Michelangelo and Horowitz, who fussed and fussed and fussed and fussed.
Traveled with pianos.
And yes, and still were always unhappy and having conniptions. And the two great non-fussy people were Richter and Arau, equally great artists who just sort of basically played what was there. And, so there you've got two deeply contrasting models, and what can you do?
Speaking of pianos, you're going to be performing for the first time in Overture Hall here in Madison.
That's right.
With our new special piano. What do you think?
Oh, it's a beautiful piano. I had my first rehearsal last night. It's a newish Hamburg Steinway that John picked out with, I forget which pianist, but it's a beautiful, spectacular instrument. No, it has a huge dynamic range and very, very happy, very pleasant to play on, and it's great.
So what do you play Chopin on?
Everything, anything you can, but not on a harpsichord. I mean, Rosalind Turek said that the greatness of Bach was that it didn't matter what the sound source was, because he didn't write, music that for a sound source. He wrote music.
You wonder if he even wrote music for instruments, exactly.
It seems to transcend,
doesn't it?
And to go back to your comment about harpsichord versus piano, my feeling is, as you can tell, I'm sort of a generalist on many things. My feeling is that if Bach could write the violin concerto in D minor, the one da-da-dum-bum-bum-bum-bum, with a slow movement which is very slow and sustained, and then write it immediately afterwards, transcribe it as a harpsichord concerto, nothing could be less like a violin than a harpsichord.
Yes.
A violin is all about sustaining, and a harpsichord is all about... And he writes the same music with no accommodation. He assumes, I think, that the harpsichord will ornament the slow movement, because otherwise there'll be much...
Lost.
There'll be a lot of gaps between notes. Yeah. But he didn't write that down particularly. So if he was willing to tolerate that difference, or in the case of keyboard music, to consider that a keyboard piece could be played on a harpsichord or clavichord or organ. Now, a piano is way less sustained than an organ, and way more sustained than a harpsichord. So therefore, if Bach felt a piece could be played on both, I don't see what... I can sit back comfortably and say, I don't see what the problem with the piano is.
That makes
great
good
point.
Sense. That's the
yeah.
first time I've heard that particular argument.
Yeah, that's how I sort of have rationalized it to myself, because I grew up in the 60s and at Juilliard, when already Bach was now the terrain of specialists who all disagreed with each other violently.
Well, there has to be another component to that, too, and maybe as a connoisseur of wine, you will agree or not with this, but the bottom line really has to be whether you like the result or not.
Exactly. Actually, yes. And I do like wine, and I live in California and know many fine winemakers in the Napa Valley, and most of them, if pressed, will say, yeah, it's a beverage of pleasure. It's not it's not an intellectual or philosophical proposition. Although it can, like music, it contains those elements.
I would, yes. I can imagine when you get to the higher levels of connoisseurship.
On the other hand, once you say, does it sound good, or do you like it, well, what does that mean? Because then we're discussing taste, which is the most
exactly.
interesting
yes.
thing.
Exactly,
subjective.
Yes. I mean, and of course, something you like is absolutely fine, but when you go to sell it, then it's a matter of whether in a concert or on a CD, it's a matter of whether the buyer will like it. It becomes a something to merchandise.
Exactly. And just as there's always the controversy of critics and, you know, orchestras and conductors and, well, you know, the critic says X and then, you know, we read the review and say, but, okay, they're entitled to their opinion, but what's it based on? And sometimes it's based on a very wonderful foundation, and sometimes you can tell from reading between the lines that it's not based on much at all.
So you read reviews?
Yeah, I'm afraid I do. I have to be honest and say that, because I know there are some colleagues of mine who say they never do, and I would believe 0.5% of them when they say that. Because I don't know anybody who is so free of ego. Well, I do know a couple, actually, and those are the ones I believe, who is so free of ego that they wouldn't actually want to read what was written about them in the paper. But I guess I'm just a very sort of average guy that way. So I have Google Alert, like, you know, it's just like a free...
Garrick Olson, and it picks up...
Actually, not everything. Even Google Alert misses certain things. Yeah. But and what is funny is you also get people's blogs.
Where they make comments on
everything, including you know, the fact that I'm tall and have a beard or not or whatever. It's like, okay, fine.
What Mr. Olson wore during the...
Well, usually it's tails, so it's not much to talk about. But anyway, I don't spend a lot of time with it. But and that's another thing, luckily, I've had enough success in my career that reviews don't make or break me.
Sure.
There comes a, and earlier in your career, they can really not exactly make or break with you, but they can be very, very, very important. But I long ago, happily, and I don't say this with any arrogance, I passed the place where, as if I got a bad review that year in New York, it doesn't feel good. But as my agent says, we just forget about that one and we reprint last year's rave review and you'll get another rave review next year, basically. But that's a feeling of security, which is very fortunate, and not everybody's fortunate enough to get there. So
yes,
I'm very well aware of that. And if I do really, really badly for a long time, everybody will notice.
I'm not expecting that to happen.
I'm not planning on it, but that's not usually what happens.
Well, we talked a little bit about this, the Chopin Etudes. Etude implies some kind of a study or
right.
a technical challenge or problem. What is Chopin showing us in the last of those Opus 10 Etudes, the one in C minor?
The last of the Opus 10 Etudes, he's showing us a great deal, the so-called revolutionary. It's obviously an etude, a study for the development of the left hands, agility, power, sonority, because even in Chopin's time, the left hand had not been as fully liberated, although Beethoven managed pretty darn well.
From the accompaniment.
Yeah, from you know, the left hand often didn't have the agility or intricacy of the right, although, you know, if you look at Chopin and indeed at Bach and Beethoven and so on, you have to be pretty... equal in both departments. But Chopin was also writing for a new instrument. In other words, the piano was in development at that point, and it could imply symphonic textures and colors. So it's a study in pedaling. But the miracle of all Chopin etudes is that they're not just studies, that he then transformed them into, you know, in this case, a magnificent piece of tragic rhetoric.
As played here by our guest today, Garrick Olson.
Mr. Garrick Olson performing music of Chopin.
And right from the start, too, if I may say so.
That's yes.
Not much of a warm-up you get for that.
And as you were saying, Garrick, if you can master the music of Chopin, these etudes, then the Rachmaninoff doesn't appear so daunting.
No, it is Chopin gives you the foundation. What Rachmaninoff and Brahms and Bartok and so those people added later is maybe 5 to 10% stuff on top of that, but no. If you can play Chopin etudes reasonably, you are doing better than 99% of pianists.
And you mentioned during the break that you're going to be doing a recording project or reissuing project.
Yes, I had recorded all of Chopin's works on the Arabesque label, and they're going to be reappearing this fall. They're going to be reissued on Hyperion as a 16 box set of the complete works of Chopin, all the piano music, which is the majority of it, concerto songs and chamber music. And then Hyperion later will be issuing 7 or 8 of the most individual, popular individual titles, you know, Etudes, Mazurkas, you know, waltzes, whatever, the most popular ones, because they realize that many people will have bought some of the arabesque previously, or they don't necessarily want to, you know, spend that much money to have all 16, because they possibly have their own favorite recordings with other pianists, but you might have heard the Etudes and liked it. So anyway, that's I'm very, very pleased about that, to have those out again.
And that'll be out in time for the holidays, it sounds like.
Yes, it should be. It's scheduled for November, and yes, and especially, as we discussed, we wanted them out for 2 Christmases before Chopin's 200th birthday, which is 2010.
Right.
And you can better believe I'll be playing lots of Chopin that year.
Bet you will, yes.
I think so.
What a wonderful repertory to work with, though.
And what you're playing this weekend is the Rachmaninoff Concerto No. 3 with the Madison Symphony Orchestra. And there are still tickets available for all 3 performances, 3 nights in a row. And that's this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 7:30, 8 o'clock, and 2:30 in the afternoon, respectively. If you're interested in tickets, that number is 608-258-4141. That's the box office number. Or you can go online at madisonsymphony.org for all the details.
And now on to more from Garrick Olson and one of his more recent releases, the Beethoven, as part of this vast cycle of all 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. This is one of the lighter, shorter ones, the sonata number 25 in G.
From a disc that won a Grammy Award last year.
And for those who are following the piano question, this is a Hamburg Steinway.
Uh-huh.